Well, thank you very much, and good morning to everybody. What I'd like to do over the next few minutes is to just offer a few thoughts that were prompted for me by the report that you've just heard so eloquently about. And these are really coming from the perspective of somebody who works primarily in global health and who focuses primarily on healthcare services and public health programs as opposed to working in the broader area of social determinants, which Paula just hinted at. But what I'd like to do first is just to congratulate the authors of the report, including my colleagues Drs. Wolf and Braverman, and Rose Martinez and the other panelists. I think this report really is truly essential reading for anybody who has an interest in public health in the U.S. I found it to be incredibly thoroughly researched and actually beautifully written. And I think, as you've heard this morning, really does serve as a wake-up call to us all. You saw these slides in Steve's presentation. The first part of the report, I think, very nicely chronicles some of the, for many of us, startling ways that the U.S. has fallen behind. This is the graph that Steve showed of female life expectancy, where the U.S. is that red dot that starts around the middle of the pack and ends up at the bottom of the pack over 30 years. As Paula just explained, the report, I thought, does quite a careful and reasoned job at seeking explanations for a range of different possible explanatory factors and submitting each of the possible factors to these three questions. Do the factors matter? Are they more common or more significant in the U.S.? And do these differences contribute to the disadvantage that we observe? So with that as a point of departure, I'd like to begin. You've already seen a lot of empirical results, but I'd like to build out some of these just a bit more with reference to the recently concluded Global Burden of Disease study. And given that you've already seen quite a lot of results, I'll try to emphasize where the GBD study offers information that I think is complementary to the quite thorough review that the panel has conducted. So let me just start very quickly by telling you what is the Global Burden of Disease for those of you who are not familiar with the study. We think of this as a systematic scientific effort to try to describe major trends and patterns around the globe by quantifying losses of health. Not economic losses, not broader welfare losses, but losses of health. And by attributing these losses to diseases, injuries, and risk factors, with a detailed accounting by age, sex, and location, and in a way that allows comparative analysis over time. Now, this initiative was originally started about 20 years ago with support from the World Bank. It was picked up about 10 years ago by the World Health Organization. And there's been more than 30 national burden of disease studies that complement the global and regional results. The latest version of this was the Global Burden of Disease 2010 study, and this took a dramatically expanded scope and ambition from prior versions of the study. For the first time, taking 187 countries as the unit of analysis and aiming to prepare estimates that were comparable at multiple points in time. A broader array of disease and injury causes, nearly 300 of them, more than 1,000 disabling sequelae of these, and almost 70 risk factors. And this was a huge collaborative enterprise, so supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with a team of several institutions serving as a scientific core, but involving almost 500 collaborators from 300 institutions in 50 countries. On the right there, you can see the special issue that The Lancet devoted to this last year, with a series of papers describing results at the global and regional levels, and that's been followed by a handful of studies extending this to look at national level results, including results for the United States published just this past summer. So let me turn to some of these results for the U.S., and again, I'll try to focus on where this study adds something to the results that Steve's already reviewed from the panel's report. But we'll start here with the total numbers of deaths. These are ages along the x-axis, and the total counts of deaths are divided into broad categories shaded in colors. You can see in the United States the well-known result that total deaths are dominated by causes of cardiovascular mortality. That's in the dark blue area. and by cancers in the light blue. Not surprisingly, you see deaths clustered at the older ages. But of course, in public health, we have a notion that we care not just about the event of death, but about the losses that are attached to that. So this idea of premature mortality reflects our idea that a death at age 80 is not the same loss of potential life as a death at age 30 or age 5. And that leads us to an interest in measures of premature mortality, like years of life lost, which is also used in the panel's report. And you can see here, if we count up the streams of life lost attached to deaths at different ages, this reintroduces us to the importance of death during the neonatal and early childhood period. You see the bars on the left showing conditions arising during the early stage of life. And it also adds an importance to causes of death at young adult ages. So you see HIV/AIDS in yellow showing up here, as well as other causes of mortality among young people, including road traffic accidents and intentional injuries. And so far, I think these results are very thoroughly covered in the report. But the next set of results is where I think the burden of disease study adds some useful additional information, and that is in turning from mortality measures to measures of non-fatal outcomes. Now, in the global burden of disease, these non-fatal outcomes are captured by estimating the prevalence of 1,160 disabling conditions, or sequelae of disabling conditions, attaching weights to reflect the severity of these, and combining these pieces of information in another measure called years lived with disability. And you can see here, as we switch from premature mortality to disability, you get a very different profile of the leading causes of burden. So now you see the massive light green or grayish area that is the mental, behavioral, and substance use disorders. You see that huge light purple area, which are the musculoskeletal disorders. And other major contributors to the non-fatal burden include diabetes in dark green and in dark purple, other non-communicable diseases, including vision and hearing loss and some of the anemias. So in short, turning to an examination or broadening the scope to examine non-fatal outcomes shows clearly that what ails you is not the same set of things that kills you. In fact, they're very much complementary sets. And so one of the major findings of the study is that we're in the midst of a significant global disability transition, whereby if you tally up the total burden of disease, more and more of that is related to disability as opposed to mortality. And in high-income countries like the U.S., more than half of the overall estimated burden was due to disability in 2010. And so the story, I think, is that we've made huge progress over the last 20 years in reducing specific causes of death globally. We've made much less progress in addressing the prevalence of chronic disability. And so it's rising importance everywhere, and it's especially prominent in places like the U.S. And putting these pieces together in a combined metric of disability-adjusted life years, you see that this really reflects the mixture of conditions that we've seen previously and gives you a much richer picture of the overall array of health problems in the population. So stepping back for a minute, you might imagine that one of the major contributions of this study, which is its ambition to provide in very great detail comparisons across countries and over time of causes of death and disability, also presents its biggest challenge, which is how do you communicate this vast array of estimates and results, more than 650 million in total for any given country, about 2 million specific results. And so this has actually prompted among the core team for the GBD an interest in trying to work on a suite of dynamic data visualization tools, and the goal really being there that anybody with a desktop or a laptop computer and an internet connection will be able to have access to these detailed results that they can explore in the ways that they see fit. And so these visualization tools are now publicly available on the website of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle, and I encourage you all to have a look. I'll show you some snapshots in a static way that only hint at what you're able to do in the dynamic versions. But this is one example of the tools. This is a tree map, which is essentially a rectangular pie chart. In this case, showing you the components of the overall burden expressed in DALYs globally in the year 2010. So the color coding distinguishes broad categories, the same ones that Steve mentioned in red, the non-communicable maternal perinatal conditions as sort of traditional public health agenda. In blue, the chronic in red, the communicable diseases, the traditional public health agenda. In blue, the non-communicable diseases. In green, the injuries. So this was the global picture in 2010, and you can drill down a little bit to more detailed causes, for example, looking at specific cancers. Now, we can rewind the global story back 20 years, and you can see the massive transition that's occurred. So the communicable diseases over the past 20 years really receding in importance and giving way to the non-communicable diseases in blue. Here's the picture in the United States in 2010, as in other high-income countries. You can see a rather advanced epidemiologic transition with a dominance of chronic diseases, especially causes of cardiovascular mortality, like ischemic heart disease up in the left corner. Below that, a major non-fatal condition, which is low back pain, as one of the top causes of disease burden. Let me briefly mention that this study also allows us to attribute health losses not just to diseases and injuries, but to the risk factors that underlie these. In the U.S., the leading risks include a constellation at the top of 14 different dietary risks, followed by tobacco smoking in second, high BMI in third, and high blood pressure and glucose, rounding out the top five. Now, the visualization tools let you combine these views. So coming back to this tree map, we can superimpose on that the portion of specific cause-related burden that's attributable to a particular risk factor. In this case, the dark shading within those cells shows you the contribution of high BMI to specific causes like ischemic heart disease in the upper corner, and in the middle of the chart, diabetes. Now, these tools are really intended to be viewed on a personal computer, so I recognize that in this sort of large meeting room, you can't pick up the details. But the main thing I wanted to give to you is a sense of how these tools have been evolving to really try to facilitate detailed exploration of the very detailed results in the study and to encourage you all to explore them when you have the chance. In the end, the goal really is to try to put high-quality information in the hands of policymakers and the public and healthcare providers and patients to start to transform the way that people think about health and the ways to make people and communities healthier. So very quickly, the final set of results I want to come back to relates more directly to one of the main goals of the report, and that's to benchmark U.S. health against health in a range of comparator countries. So these are the 16 countries that you've heard about in the rows of this chart, and the columns in this case show you the 20 leading causes of premature mortality. You probably can't read these cells, but they give you the ranks among the 17 countries. They're color-coded so that red indicates those causes for which the U.S. Fares significantly worse than the average of these 17 countries. Green is where the U.S. fares significantly better, and yellow is where the U.S. results are statistically indistinguishable. And so one thing you can see here, as Steve mentioned, is that there is some good news. Among the leading causes of premature mortality, the U.S. does quite well in stroke, colorectal cancer, and breast cancer. But there is a whole lot of bad news as well, as you heard about. In terms of overall age-adjusted mortality, the U.S. is at the bottom of the list here, and this is true as well for many of the specific causes. Very quickly, if we turn to the non-fatal side, these are the years lived with disability, we see two different things. First, the U.S. rises much higher on the list overall, so ranked third in terms of the overall burden relating to non-fatal conditions. And you see does quite well for specific problems like low back pain, falls, and migraine. But the other thing that you notice in this chart is that there's a sea of yellow, which suggests that there's way more uncertainty around the non-fatal outcomes across these similar countries and with regard to the ranking of these. So let me end with a few thoughts regarding the search for explanations. I appreciated the panel's statement on the matter of answers, and it's a sentiment that I quite share. So rather than trying to offer explanations, what I want to do is reflect very briefly on some of the conclusions in the report and on the agenda it sets out, and I'll add a couple of small items to these. With regard to research, the panel calls for better data on health outcomes and their determinants, for more international collaboration and broader data access, for improved methods, and for sustained funding. I agree completely with all of the items on this agenda. My addition is mainly one of emphasis, where I would suggest a particular focus on improving data and analytics around non-fatal outcomes, recognizing that these constitute a large and growing proportion of the overall burden. On the role of health systems, the panel concludes that healthcare has only a partial influence on health outcomes in combination with other important determinants. And I note the nice work by Jessica Ho and Sam Preston, which looked in particular at mortality from breast cancer and prostate cancer, where the U.S. does well, and they concluded that the low longevity ranking of the U.S. is therefore not likely to be a result of a poorly functioning healthcare system. On this point, I'd suggest a need to link burden of disease to health system factors in a more disaggregated way that lets us drill down to healthcare utilization and expenditures linked up to the same categories that we look at burden of disease, those disease, injury, and risk factor categories. And I think by connecting the burden with information on expenditures, we can really start to generate hypotheses about specific health system factors driving what we do well and where we're faring poorly. And finally, on the next steps, the panel recommends another report be done that focuses on evaluating evidence for health-promoting policies in other top-performing countries as a way of identifying promising strategies in the U.S. And to this, finally, I'd add the following priorities for study in the U.S. First, I think we can move beyond the question of whether the healthcare system overall is poorly functioning and turn to why the U.S. healthcare system produces some of the best outcomes on some selected outcomes while it does the worst on others. And here I think it would be fruitful to focus not just on areas of disadvantage, but also areas where the U.S. leads in the rankings. The fact that there are these areas suggests that that poor outcomes in the U.S. are not inevitable. And as the final recommendation, I think it's time to reevaluate the mandate for comparative effectiveness research. First, I think we need to balance the emphasis there on broader public health interventions and policies, in addition to clinical ones. And finally, and I would actually put this as my top priority, I think we really need to get serious at last about admitting costs and cost effectiveness into the whole enterprise of comparative effectiveness research. And so this is the way President Obama characterized comparative effectiveness, but I think it's pretty emblematic of the rhetoric on either side of the aisle in Washington. The president said if there's a blue pill and a red pill and the blue pill is half the price of the red pill and works just as well, why not pay half price for the thing that's going to make you well? The problem with this is that it's really a caricature. It's part of the rhetoric that pretends that there aren't hard choices, that we can find magically savings by looking for the blue pill instead of the red pill. And perhaps this speaks to Paula's closing point, which is the idea that we're in a culture that values individualism and survival of the fortunate. And we want to pretend that we don't have to make the hard choices by recognizing that some of the resources we use are producing greater value for money than others. And I suggest we really need to start to take seriously the idea of asking questions about cost and cost effectiveness as part of the broad agenda that's taking hold on comparative effectiveness. So let me end there, and thank you all very much.